Okay, everybody. So, nice to see so many people here. It's amazing how many people are here. It's great because maybe it is difficult times in Singapore, and that's why so many people are coming here. And that is, of course, also the topic of this evening's talk, is about difficult times and how to have a positive attitude. In fact, how to deal with difficult times. This is the topic for this evening's talk. And the first thing to notice when you think that you have very hard times in Singapore, and I know that things I've read in the newspapers that the economy in Singapore is not doing so well, but when you read in the paper, you also realize very quickly that Singapore is not in a unique situation. This is a global problem. This is something you see everywhere around the world. Excuse me. You see there are countries, lots of wealthy countries around the world are doing really, really badly economically. You see it everywhere. And of course, some of the countries which are worst hit because they are already poor are the poor countries. And I think I read a statistic somewhere that there's now 50 million people or something like that more who live on less than a dollar a day around the world. Imagine living on a dollar a day. Even if it is a cheap country and the things aren't very expensive, a dollar a day is an extraordinary small amount. So there's poverty around the world, real poverty in a very very bad kind of way. So this is the first thing to realize. It's not unique. This is something that you see everywhere. The second thing to realize is that even though these times are bad, even in good times, there are people around, even in Singapore, who go bankrupt. There are companies that go down. There are people who have enormous problems, even in the good times. So this is not something that just happens when the times are bad. When the times are bad, it becomes much more prominent. We see the problem. But the problem is always there. There's always somebody who has a problem economically, losing their job, losing their social status, whatever it is. This is happening continuously and all the time. The only reason why it becomes so powerful now is because it's happening to the whole world. And that's why we understand it. That's why we see it so clearly, rather. But the fact is that this is always happening here. So it's not so much the idea, the thing is not so much the reason why these times are difficult. It's not so much because there happens to be an economic crisis. That's not the reason why things are difficult for somebody. The reason why things are difficult for people is ultimately it comes back down to the Buddhist idea of karma. And of course, if you have some karma that needs to ripen for yourself, then whether times are good or times are bad, it makes absolutely no difference. So in a sense, this is just the reflection that you should use now while times are bad is to remind yourself that this can happen at any time. Nobody knows their karma. We don't know what we did in the past life. And because we don't know that, this can happen almost at any time. And that is the important reflection to remember here. So this is like a wake-up call. It reminds us that this is a possibility in life almost at any time. So this is the starting point of your attitude, how you should deal with this kind of situation. Why is it that things become so difficult when economic times are bad or anything else is bad? What is the cause? What is the root cause for this? And the root cause is always attachment in the mind. Because we are attached, that is why change, economic catastrophe, and the other catastrophe, that's why it's so painful, because we have attachments there. Attachments mean we have a vested interest in things. We think that things have to be in a certain way. We hold on to that certain way for things to be. And because we hold on to that way for certain things to be, when they change, it becomes painful for us. Why do we attach in the first place? Why do human beings have these attachments? And the reason why we attach as human beings is because we think that somewhere, some of these things are going to make us happy. We attach to a partner in life because we think a partner is going to make us happy. We attach to the house that we build or the apartment that we have because we see a certain amount of happiness in this house, this apartment. And it's because we rely on these things to give ourselves happiness, that's why we attach to them. And of course, then when change comes, it destroys our partnership. It breaks up our marriage. We have to sell our house. We lose our job. We lose our social status. Whatever it is, it feels painful because we have a vested interest. We think this is going to give us happiness. And that is why it is difficult. So this is the problem with the Buddhist idea of impermanence. that it goes against our attachments. It goes against the way we want things to be in the world. And that is why it is so difficult. So that is like just a small introduction for you, what this talk essentially is going to be about. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about this idea, Buddhist idea of impermanence, because what lies behind this whole problem that we're seeing today in Singapore and around the world is precisely the idea of impermanence. And sometimes you hear people say, yeah, I understand impermanence. And then when the problem arises, they still suffer. How come you understand impermanence and you still suffer afterwards? And I remember a couple of years ago I went to Indonesia, and I had recently had some floods in Indonesia. People were in great strife, much more strife than people are in a wealthy country like Singapore usually, or anywhere in the Western world for that matter. And people were, these are just, you know, subsistence farmers in Indonesia. They have a little paddy field, they live on that, maybe they sell a little bit if they have some extra. And they had some storms and some great floods. It wiped out everything they had. And in Indonesia, for a rice farmer, if he wipes out everything you have, then you haven't got anything to eat. So it's a terrible situation. And I was there to give a talk, and I'm not sure how much they understood, because the talk was translated into Indonesian. So I'm not sure how much actually came across. But I said, well, you know, this is a matter of impermanence. This is what you can expect in life sometimes. Things go up, things go down. You never know what's going to happen next. This is a very complicated situation. And somebody in the crowd said, yeah, I understand all this about impermanence. How come I'm still suffering? And I said, you haven't understood impermanence. That's why you're suffering. The truth of impermanence is very profound. It's not something you can just read in a Buddhist book and say, yes, I understand this. It's not an intellectual type of understanding. It's a deep, profound kind of understanding which you only can really understand by reflecting on it again and again and again, time after time, year after year, month after month. And then when you do that, do it together with all your other Buddhist practice, that is when it starts to sink in. That's when you start to understand what this impermanence is really about. It's not a superficial thing. It's a profound thing. It's something to do with insight and real understanding. So because of that, I want to talk a little bit, first of all, about this thing we call impermanence, and maybe show you a few areas of impermanence that you haven't considered before. And afterwards, I will talk about the way out. How can we deal with this in a way that makes us suffer less when impermanence comes, as it must do sooner or later? I should maybe say, first of all, that impermanence, sometimes we talk about impermanence when things go bad. But of course, impermanence is also when things turn back up again and go well again. That's also impermanence. So impermanence is all this thing going up, going down. Ultimately, impermanence just means we don't know what's going to happen next. That's what it really means. It's uncertainty. We have no idea what's going to happen. It could go down. We could have a downturn at last for the next 10 years. Who knows? It might be unlikely, but it's certainly possible according to the Buddha's teachings. Anything is really possible. So to start off talking about impermanence, you will have noticed that when the financial system crashes around the world, it's a systemic kind of impermanence. It's like a certain part of society which doesn't function anymore. The financial system collapses, and that system of finance doesn't work properly anymore. And you will see that this is true of many of the systems that we have in our society. Many of the systems are impermanent. We often don't even reflect on that. Take, for example, the healthcare system. I'm not really familiar with how things are in Singapore so much, but I know how they are in Australia, because that's where I've been living for the past 15 years. And you read the paper, and people are complaining about the health system. The queues are too long. They don't get the operation at the right time. The doctors are doing a bad job. There isn't enough money for the health system, etc. Always complaining about it. Always something wrong. But the point is that we have to remember all of these human-created systems, the people in them, the administration, the way it runs, they are all impermanent. They're not going to be solid things. They cannot last forever. They are impermanent because there's all kinds of pressures at work on these kinds of systems, all kinds of things which always means that they will have to change with the times. They will have to be done differently from what they've been done before. So the systems that we create in our society are impermanent. So the right reflection then, when you see that, for example, I don't know if it happens in Singapore, if people complain about the healthcare system here. I'm sure they do. I think it happens everywhere. But the right way, if something goes wrong in the health system, is not to complain. is not to try to find a scapegoat, try to find somebody who has done something wrong. When you read the papers, they're always trying to find somebody to blame. I think that's human nature, was to find some kind of scapegoat for the problem. But that is the wrong way around it. Why is it the wrong way? It's the wrong way because it is the nature of the healthcare system to break down sometimes. It's the nature of the system not to work properly. This is just the way it is. It could be human error. It doesn't have to be human error. It could be some other error. So there's no point in trying to blame somebody and trying to find some scapegoat for the system. The right way, rather, to approach a systemic breakdown, wherever it is to ask ourselves, well, why is there a problem? And then search for the problem with a cool mind, without getting upset and angry at the government or at individuals or whatever. And then when you find the problem with a cool mind, then, of course, you are in the best possible position to rectify it. And this goes for all the problems in life. If something doesn't work, keep cool, keep easy. Don't try to find or blame anybody. Instead, just search for the problem in a cool way, and then you can solve it in the best possible way. This is the right way. Sometimes when I see the newspapers complaining about this and that and the other, I think this is not the right way. This doesn't make any sense. Stop complaining. Instead, try to find a solution to these problems. And then maybe we can move forward. And you will find the same thing, not only in the, of course, the healthcare system. You find all kinds of systems in society have the same problem. You find the educational system sometimes doesn't work properly. People don't get the education that they are entitled to or they should have to bring society forward. Again, don't get upset and angry if it doesn't work. Instead, be creative, try to find the solution to the problem, and then we can actually move forward. So this is a systemic problem. Take also the political system, for example. There's so much complaint about politics, I think almost any country you go. But remember that political systems...
Whether it is...
Okay. Yeah. This is another sign of impermanence. A nice kind of call comes to you. That's, sometimes impermanence is good. So that's very kind of you. And there is so much complaint about politics around the world. Wherever you go, you find people complaining about politicians, complaining about people being corrupt, not doing the right thing. But remember that our political system is also inherently unstable. It's always changing. We may think that democracy is a wonderful thing, and it's sort of the way forward in the world. But democracy itself is changing all the time. When I look at the way things are done, for example, in the United States, around the world, you can see how they have to refine and change the laws all the time to do things differently, because the system as it is crumbling right there and then. They have to have, in the U.S. a couple of years ago, they had this thing they called campaign finance reform, because there was too much money in the system, and the money in the system was corrupting democracy, so they had to change the money in the system. Less money to be given by corporations to politicians, etc. So again, we shouldn't be too surprised if the democratic system eventually will sort of fade away because it doesn't work anymore. The interesting thing, actually, when it comes to government, if you look at the way, for example, the suttas, the word of the Buddha, the way they talk about government, the ideal government in the suttas is not really, or not necessarily, a democratic system. In the suttas, they talk about something they call a world-ruling monarch, like an autocratic person who has full control over large areas of land. And when you have a world-ruling monarch who practices and lives according to the Dhamma, who does what is right, who follows the precepts, who is generous, who looks after his subjects, look after the people in the land, then that, according to Buddhism, is the ideal kind of government. Because, of course, if you have absolute power, if you are a good person, you can implement that goodness in a beautiful way. Probably much better than you can in a democracy, where you always have to horse trade, you always have to sort of find the lowest or a common denominator anyway between the people. So again, it's interesting and fascinating to see how incredibly uncertain things are and how they always crumble, how they're always subject to falling away, to impermanence, and all these kind of things. Another thing which has occurred to me is also impermanent, which also is very important, and people often don't think about our ideas, the way we look at the world, the way our political opinions, our opinions about what is good and bad, our religious ideas, these things are also impermanent. And of course, often we argue about politics, or we argue about who is right and wrong in a particular case, who is the good guy and who is the bad guy here. You always argue about these things. But remember, remind yourself that your opinions will change. What you think is the right political solution today, next year you might think is the wrong political solution. And it's the same thing for religion. You might think that you have a very clear idea of what ethics and morality is in the Buddhist system, but maybe you haven't got such a clear idea. Maybe next year you have new ideas about how ethics and morality works in Buddhism. And because your ideas are so changing, they're always different, they always go from one thing to something else. Because of that, when you have a discussion with somebody, be more open-minded. Don't be so strong in your personal opinions. Accept that maybe next year you will have the opinion that the other person has. Maybe you won't. Maybe the other person will have the opinion you have next year. And reflect on that impermanence of the mind, the impermanence of our ideas, the impermanence of how we actually look at the world. Take the generation clashes, for example. Often parents will argue with children, children will argue with parents. And this is often because we have grown up in different societies. We look at the world in different ways, so we have different ideas. Because we have different ideas, we think differently. But when your children grow up, they might change. They might look at things differently. And then, of course, that problem will be solved. So in this way, you can have more compassion, you can have more understanding by realizing that your ideas are not as permanent as they may seem to be. Ideas can seem so strong and so powerful. You can be so convinced that the only way in life is to be a Buddhist. And then 2 years hence, you are something else. You know, this happens. It happens with people. I've seen so many monks ordaining and saying, oh, this is the right thing. I'm going to be a monk for the rest of my life. There's no doubt at all that I'm going to be a monk for the rest of my life. A few years later on, they have disrobed and they have given up the monkhood. Why? Because of impermanence. Because they couldn't see what was coming. They couldn't see, didn't realize that something would happen which would change their mind. And that, again, is the same problem. So, these are some of the areas of impermanence which you may not have considered before. Another area which I also find is very important is, of course, the material world, the physical world. And I ask you for a very simple thing like your house. How important is that to you? If your house were to burn down or an earthquake were to destroy it, then how would you feel about that? And most people will feel terrible because the house is something which is very close to them. It is a place you live. It's a place you furnish in your way that you like. You decorate it in your way. It's a place where you find safety from the world. You get away from the weather. You get away from the world around you. It's a place of refuge for most people. Of course, if that refuge gets destroyed, then it is painful. And that is the way that it is for almost everybody here. I remember a few years ago, Ajahn Brahm was telling me the story when we had a big fire going through Bodhinyana Monastery. It's about almost 20 years ago now. And he said he saw this big fire coming towards Bodhinyana Monastery, which is our monastery in Perth. Enormous big fire jumping from tree to tree, burning practically everything in its path. And he thought, this is surely the end of Bodhinyana Monastery. It will all burn down. There will be nothing left of the monastery. And he said right there and then, he just let go of the entire thing. And he said it would be any problem at all. If the whole thing burned down, he'd be perfectly happy. And you have to consider that he had spent all his time in the preceding 8 years building this monastery. Practically all this time building it up. And he was able to let go there on the spot. That is quite a powerful example for us. This is the ideal way of behaving when disaster looms. We can let go right there and then. And of course, our attachments are also to all kinds of material things. The way, very often, one of the nice ways of deciding, well, what is your strongest attachment in the world? Put all your worldly belongings into one place. And then imagine, or put it into your house, and then set fire. Imagine in your mind that you're setting fire to your house. What is the first thing you would run into the house to get? Now that is where your strongest attachment is. That is a nice way of figuring out your attachments. One way that I used to think of attachments as well at Bodhinyana Monastery, it was said in the introduction here, I've been part of quite a bit of the building work. Sometimes it's a bit exaggerated, these introductions. I've been part of some of the building work, certainly not everything. Ajahn Brahm has done much, much more than I ever have. But anyway, sometimes when I build these little huts that we have in the monastery, Sometimes I get a bit obsessed with building the hut. We've got to get this ready by a certain time. We've got to be perfect. Got to be this way and got to be that way. And sometimes I feel my mind isn't as peaceful about this building's work as it should be. I shouldn't be rushing around. I shouldn't be going too fast. There are more things in a monk's life that are more important than building a hut. That is being peaceful, for example. So I remind myself that this thing that I'm building here right now, it is impermanent. And then I start looking at the hut, and sure enough, as soon as you put up one brick, as soon as you put up something, something else already starts to crumble. It's amazing how quickly it starts to crumble, almost straight away as you build it up. And then I start looking at the old huts in the monastery, and I see that the old huts, some of the bricks are starting to come off in the corners, a little bit of rust you find on the roofing section, the gutters aren't straight anymore, you can see how things are collapsing so fast. Very oldest huts in the monastery, they've already been demolished because the standard wasn't high enough. They've already gone away. Impermanence again. And then I reflect, well, what will it be like in 100 years' time from now? In 200 years' time from now? And of course, slowly but surely, those huts are going to be more and more derelict. They're going to look worse and worse until the point comes, I don't know when, 300 years' time, 400 years' time, this is a very hopeful estimate. Maybe I'm being in denial myself here. But at some stage, the time will come when these huts are no longer inhabitable. You can't live there anymore. And then the monastery will no longer be a monastery. It will just be a pile of ruins, old huts, old meditation halls, sitting in the forest in Australia. And eventually, it will crumble more and more. Until one day, maybe 1,000 years, maybe 2,000 years, I don't know how long it's going to take, all this going to be left there, a little piles in the forest. On those piles will be trees growing, there will be grass growing, kangaroos grazing. And if you dig a little bit into those piles, you will see there's some rubble under there. There's old bricks sitting in that rubble. And eventually, of course, there will barely be a sign of the monastery at all. And then one day an archaeologist will come and they will dig into the pile and they will say, wow, look at this. This is interesting, isn't it? There was something here 3,000 years ago. We have no idea what it was, but it was something here. Maybe it was a Christian monastery or something. And at that point, even the idea of Buddhism will have disappeared. People won't even know that it was a Buddhist monastery anymore. You can see how impermanent it is. Incredibly impermanent. It's sad in a sense. There's a thriving monastery there now. And that monastery will be completely gone. Even the memory will be gone. Even the idea of Buddhism will be gone. And that is how impermanent it will be. And this is a sign of the impermanence in our lives. How things get washed away by this wave of impermanence rolling over the world at all the times. So these are just some ideas for you to reflect on, because it's very important to reflect on this thing that we call impermanence. And this brings me to the second part of the talk, because now I've given you some ideas. How do we actually deal with this? What is the best way? What are some strategies of coming to terms with this thing that we call impermanence? And the first thing that you have to realize is that the Buddha said in many, many places in the suttas that it's important to reflect on this thing we call impermanence. It's not something which we should take for granted or something which is we just know, yes, yes, it's the Buddha's teaching. We should regularly reflect on this truth. This is the first thing to understand, because when you reflect on this regularly, what happens? Your attachments become a little bit less. There's no magic thing that you will let go of all your attachments straight away. This robe refuses to be attached to me, that's for sure. So there's no chance that you will get rid of those attachments all straight away, definitely. But it's a gradual thing, and as you think about this, you will become less and less attached. And as you become less attached, you will feel more free, you will feel more happy, you will have a much better life because of that reduction in attachment. So then, the first reflection then is the kind of reflection that I've been talking about now, thinking about impermanence, thinking about the various guises it takes, the various ways it comes, how society, always, everything around us is basically impermanent. How the body is impermanent, how we age. When we look ourselves in the mirror, we're not so happy as we were a year ago because there's more wrinkles there, we're a little bit fatter than we were before, and all these kind of things. Things are just basically impermanent. And the more you can understand and reflect in this way, the more you are going, as I said, to have less attachments to things. How does this work? Because when you see that things are impermanent, you see the disadvantage in the worldly things. You see the danger in this worldly things. You know that you have an attachment, because you can see that if it disappears, it will hurt you, you will feel bad. Because you know you have an attachment, and because you know the law of impermanence of things, you know that there is a danger there. There's a potential for being hurt. There's a potential for you to suffer in the future. So then, because you see that danger, as you contemplate impermanence, your grip releases all by itself. You don't have to be particularly, there's no wisdom really beyond that. This is the wisdom itself. The grip will release all by itself. And this is one of those fundamental parts of the understanding what Buddhism is all about. Very often you might go on a meditation retreat with somebody, and very often you hear the question is often, how do I let go? Everybody says you must let go of everything, you can't hold on to things, that's the only way to get into deep meditation. But how do I let go? And very often people haven't got a clue how, they just get told you must let go. And what you have to do, and this is the answer to this question, how you let go, and it's explained in the suttas, is called the adinavasanya, the perception of danger in things. When you see that something is dangerous, when you see that something is liable to give you suffering, when you understand that, the deeper you understand that, the more easily you can let go of that thing. And that is the answer to how we let go of things. Understanding the danger in things. Understanding the potential that things have to give us suffering in the future. That is the answer. So the more deeply you understand the danger in the world around you, in all these external things, the more easy it will be for you to let go of those things. That is how it works. It's really quite straightforward. I think if you think about it, it makes quite good psychological sense. There's nothing hocus pocus in this. There's nothing you have to believe which is magical or anything like that. It's just natural way of how the mind works in the world. I'm sure any psychologist might tell you the same. So this then becomes the first aspect of reflection, how to overcome and how to make it less painful for us to live in this world which changed so much. Reflect on these things. Now the other aspect of how to overcome the problem is the development of the mind. Because unless you develop your mind, unless you have a mind which has some source of happiness apart from those external things, you won't be able to let go. You won't be able to let go because we need to find happiness somewhere. If you only have happiness in the external things, you can't let go of them because you lose that source of happiness in your life. So you have to search for an alternative source of happiness. And then when you have happiness in your heart, something from somewhere else, a sense of contentment, satisfaction in life, a sense of independence, because if you have a sense of contentment and satisfaction and fulfillment in your life, you also feel independent. When you have that, only then can you really start to let go properly, because you have a source of happiness which is impregnable, which cannot be touched by the world outside. So imagine yourself, if you have a source of happiness inside of you, then of course the external world doesn't matter so much anymore. Whether there is a financial crisis in Singapore, even if your partner dies or gets very ill or whatever, it is not going to touch you in the same way as it did before. It's still very likely to touch you, because these things are very painful things for most people. It takes a long time to overcome your attachment to your wife or husband or partner 100%. It's very difficult. You have to become fully enlightened, according to the Buddha's teaching, to do that. But it will help. It will lessen the suffering. And you get a source of happiness inside of you, which is independent of the external world. And that is a powerful thing, to have a sense of independence. You feel a sense of freedom. Independence and freedom are really two aspects of the same thing. Because you have a strength inside of you, a power inside of you, which very few people have. It makes you so strong in the meeting, the vicissitudes and the problems of the world. And that is the beautiful thing about it. And of course, you all know already how to develop that mind, because that's what most Buddhist talks are about. How to go about making that home inside of yourself, which is free, which is happy, which is content, which is peaceful. And that is, of course, just by practicing the Buddha's teachings, practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, doing all those things that we know that we should be doing already. So whether that is the five precepts or generosity or a bit of meditation or just kindness and compassion in daily life, all of these things are part of that practice. And I want to just dwell very briefly on why is it that practicing the Buddhist path makes us more happy. What is actually the mechanism here? Because all of these things are really psychology. And Buddhism can be, in many ways, be regarded as a science of psychology in a certain way, with a certain particular type of emphasis. What is going on here? And what is going on, and this is again explained in the suttas by the Buddha. The Buddha said, if we do something bad, you have remorse for that badness that you have done. You feel bad afterwards. And sometimes you may not even be able to realize that you are feeling bad. But it's almost as if you do something bad, it's a bit like there's a shadow coming inside your mind. It's darkening the mind a little bit, making the mind a little bit less content, making it a space in which it's not so nice to live anymore. There's a darkness coming inside. Whether you understand that it is remorse or not, is not really the issue. There's something there which makes the mind less pleasant. And this is bad news, because the more bad actions we do, the more this will tend to heap up, and the darkness becomes worse and worse. And if you are a person who regularly does bad things, like certain people might do, like lying regularly, or cheating people regularly, or whatever it is, that darkness is eventually going to become all-encompassing. And of course, this is how the idea of rebirth comes about in Buddhism. And when you create a dark mind for yourself, then when you die, you are going to get reborn in a dark place, because the mind is going to be right there in the dark spot straight away as you die. And it is that mind that you take with you in a future life. So of course, you're going to have that mind with you. You're going to suffer accordingly. You go to a dark place. And when you do good actions, it's exactly the opposite. When you avoid the bad acts, you don't have this remorse in the mind anymore. You don't have this darkness in the mind. And when you do a good act, you actually, instead of having darkness, you're bringing light into the mind. You're bringing something beautiful into the mind. Why is that? Because you reflect about it. If you do something nice in the world, spontaneously, you do something beautiful, you help somebody out, you give a donation somewhere you didn't even think about at the time. And suddenly, because you do something spontaneously kind, there's a sense of joy and happiness happening inside of you. I'm sure many of you have had that experience before. It's a very common experience. And, of course, that joy and happiness, if you look at your mind at that time, you will see it's a beautiful mind state. It's a bright mind state, a mind state which is peaceful, which is has generosity and compassion. All these beautiful characteristics are in that mind at that time. And the more we then practice the path in the correct way, the more we turn up the lights inside the mind, the more beautiful the mind becomes, the better you feel about yourself, the more at ease you feel, the more relaxed you feel, the less stressed out you feel, the more sense of confidence you have about yourself. Because you can imagine one of the reasons why we are nervous about things, maybe public speaking, for example. The reason one is nervous about public speaking is because you're afraid what people are going to think about you. You think, oh, what are they going to think about me when I sit up here talking about this? But of course, the more your source of happiness is inside your own mind, the more independent you are of all these external things. It doesn't matter so much what other people think anymore. It doesn't matter whether you have all these bad things happening around you, because you have built up a beautiful and bright mind inside of yourself. So this is how the spiritual life can help you in overcoming the problems of impermanence, because you become independent. You gain a strength, a power inside of you, which otherwise you could never have. And then you can see what's happening here is that you have a beautiful, bright mind. And then when you reflect on impermanence as well, that beautiful, bright mind makes it easier to reflect on impermanence. It makes it easier to let go, because you have a refuge inside of yourself. You don't need the external things anymore so much, because you don't need them so much. You can let go of those external things. So this reflection of impermanence goes together with the practice of the path. And together, they become a very powerful tool to overcome these things. What then is the positive attitude that you should have? The positive attitude you should have is that all of you who are coming here today, you have a refuge, I'm not sure if all of you consider yourself Buddhist or whether you're just interested in Buddhism. But even if you just come here because you're interested in the Buddha's teachings, you still have a kind of refuge, because the teachings you get here are things that you can use in your daily life. There are different ways of doing things. And the refuge in Buddhism basically means that we have a place to go when we have a question, we have a problem. There's somewhere we can go to get an answer. There's somewhere that can help us out to move in the right direction. That is what a refuge is. And each one of you here today, you have that refuge already. And those of you who are Buddhists, who maybe practice the five precepts, been doing meditation for a long time, you have even more than a refuge. You have something additional. Because already, if you do these things already, the impact of the financial crisis as it is now is going to be much less for you than it is going to be for those people who are not practicing in this way. You already have a great advantage in the fact that you have practiced for so long. It may not be easy to see, but if you imagine yourself the person you are now compared to the person you were before, I think you will probably realize that you have more resistance towards these external shocks because you have something inside of yourself which can actually meet with those things. So that is the positive attitude. Know that you are already doing what is right, doing what is good. You're moving in the right direction. You already have found a lot of resistance against external shocks already. And if you keep practicing in the same way, that resistance against external shocks, against financial crisis, whatever it is, will just become stronger and stronger and stronger as time goes by. And eventually, of course, depending on how life goes, eventually you will become completely, absolutely resistant against those external things. So that is my talk this evening.
It's questions and answers time. Any questions for Ajahn? On this topic or any topic?
Good evening, Ajahn. Your talk was such an inspiring. What I don't understand, the parts that you're saying about letting go, it seems so easy, right? But it is also not hard, because it seems like, you know, if you say let go, it seems like it's so easy to achieve it, so, but it's so elusive. In other words to say is that by letting go of impermanence, you see, the part which I don't understand, you see, sometimes we do something which is superficial. Why? Something that we do, we thought that we do good, but it's just the outer space, and that is most of us. Most of us are doing that. Why? That's the reason behind. There must be a reason behind.
You're asking why is it that we do superficial things and it doesn't go to the heart? Is that what you're asking?
If you say that impermanence, right? You're saying that everything is impermanent, right? But if you are doing it with the heart, right? Like suppose I want to help somebody. I help without condition, right? So that is not impermanence, right? But yeah. What do you mean by impermanence, like letting go?
Okay, so you're saying that if you do something spiritual, I'm saying it's not impermanent, but whereas you do something in the material world,
it's
impermanent.
Doing something is through the heart.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Not superficial, just because I want to help,
Okay.
That kind. So, I don't understand on the impermanence you're saying, but if you are doing it through the heart, is that impermanence?
Okay, I'm not 100% sure if I understand you, but I'll try to answer anyway, and if I don't answer, you can come back, okay? I think even if you do an action from the heart, if you do something beautiful, do something kind, if you keep the five precepts and these things are also ultimately, they're also impermanent. They're not going to last forever. But the point is that they are much more permanent than the world around you. The world around you is incredibly impermanent, and things can change so fast. But if you create a lot of good karma in this life, it is something which can take you forward for lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes in the future. So it is wrong to say that it is permanent, but it is more permanent, or less impermanent, if you like, than the things of the world. And not only is it less impermanent, but it also takes you in the direction of enlightenment, slowly but surely. And of course, because it takes you in the direction of enlightenment, it takes you ultimately to a final solution to all the problems in life. And that is the most important thing, maybe, that it moves you, first of all, it moves you towards a better state of living here and now, and also in future lives, and ultimately it also drives you towards enlightenment, ultimately. So it is true that impermanence covers everything. It also it covers our good acts, but remember that those good acts are worth doing, even though they are impermanent, because they last for a very long time into the future. Is that what you were asking, or was it something else? Something like that, yeah? Okay, okay.
Because you are talking about heart, it's the impermanence, right? It's impermanence, yeah. Right? Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry. Other than financial crises or all kind of impermanence, even just now you mentioned about religion also can be impermanent. By 3,000 years later, maybe Buddhism will no longer be around. Okay, during Buddha's time, there is this Kalama Sutta that actually helped the Kalamas to identify what is the right religion, which in those times also there are many religions. But come to today's world, we also have many religions. Whereby even Buddhism itself is divided into so many sects, you know. So, as an individual, when you look out in the world and you want to find the truth, you know, and no doubt Kalama Sutta do give some bearing to find the direction. Do not believe if it's because of old age, old time. Do not believe it's because of a mess. Do not believe it's mythical tradition. You know, so many, about 10 over. For a guideline, but if you look at all the old religion like Christianity, which is for a long time, Muslim, you know, Mahayana, Theravada, all seems like real. Okay, then now the last part of Buddha's word is that if it actually conforms to certain things, certain, you know, to the goodness, you know, and if I didn't get it wrongly, is it that the last part you mentioned, it goes according to your heart? To your way of thought at the point where you select your religion?
There's many things about the Kalama Sutta, but the first thing to understand about the Kalama Sutta, it was given to somebody or a group of people who didn't know anything much about Buddhism at all. You know, they were just ignorant about what was going on. And because they were very ignorant, it was a very simple teaching. It was basically saying, well, you know, if something is if something leads to your happiness, you know it's a good teaching. If something leads to your unhappiness, you know it's a bad teaching. So follow those teachings which lead to your happiness. And that is a general, you know, it is still a general valid point. You know, if something leads towards your happiness, then it is a good thing. And I, you know, and the thing to do is to look at all these religions. I don't agree that they're all the same. I far from it. I think they're very, very different, these religions. And it's actually quite important to investigate, well, which ones of these give you something which is acceptable, something which you, you know, can fully, with your hand on your heart, really believe is teaching you the truth. And I think that is the way we have to investigate. And then you will understand whether something can actually, you know, is the right thing to do or not. And one of the ways of investigating that, which I have, obviously we have to hear different teachings, is to understand what the Buddha taught. And when I read the teachings of the Buddha, I find it so beautiful. It is so meaningful. It makes such good sense. It is just an ordinary psychology, which just fits with modern view of psychology, fits with the modern way the universe works. You know, it's sensible teachings. These are not some airy-fairy, pie-in-the-sky kind of thing. It actually works. It actually makes sense. And this is the kind of thing you have to use your rational mind when we evaluate religions. We can't have this thing where we put our rational mind to one side and pretend that we're just going to make a make a commitment based on the heart, what feels right. You have to investigate these things. And then when you come to a rational decision that this is right, then you know that it's going to be much more solid than just an emotional reaction to something. Yeah. And one of the things which I've always been found very good in Buddhism is that you don't have to choose, for example, between science and Buddhism. You can actually believe in both science and Buddhism at the same time. It's not one or the other, it's both. And for me, that is the only acceptable way things can be. Because science is a search for truth. It's a search for reality. You can't just reject those scientific truths just because it doesn't fit your belief system. That becomes silly, in my opinion. And as a Buddhist, I feel confident that as long as Buddhism conforms with a scientific outlook, I can be a Buddhist. I can be proud of being a Buddhist. If science should eventually prove beyond doubt that my Buddhist faith is misplaced, it's wrong, then I would also give up my Buddhist faith because there wouldn't be any doubt anymore that something was wrong there. So we have to be open to these things. I think it's very important. So use a rational mind. That's what I would recommend. Yeah,
thank you. And just now you mentioned about the idea of so-called to understand the danger that arises from the impermanence. Okay, from there, then you will be able to identify the real problem and to let go because you have seen the danger of the impermanence. That one is something which is new to me, and it's more elaborate. It's not saying new, but it's more elaborate. I thank you very much because that is a very clear-cut meaning of letting go. By looking at the danger, understanding the danger of the impermanence, and then find a solution to it, and whether you're going to let go or want to continue with it, the choice is there. You can see it so clearly. Just like you mentioned that if the house looks old, you look at it, you can identify that it's old. Are you going to renovate it or are you going to break it down? You can make a division there. Yeah, thank you very much.
Challenge.
Thank you for the talk. And I'm not practicing Buddhist, but hearing your talk, being all this impermanence and even doing good deeds is impermanence. To someone who doesn't believe in rebirth or reincarnation, life will appear very meaningless, isn't it? That everything you do is so meaningless, is nothing permanent if you don't believe in this process of rebirth. Second question is about attachment. I think attachment is something very biological, some survival value in for the kids, you know, like baby attachment, all that. So if you don't, even you see this as something impermanent and you break away from that, you actually bring a lot of grief to the people around you, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So the first one was about rebirth, and if you don't believe in rebirth, then how does this actually work? And the point is that the good actions that you do in this life are not only for future lives, they're also about this life right here and now. And that's why I was mentioning if you do something good spontaneously, you feel something in your heart. There's a beautiful feeling in the heart, and you can actually build up a bright mind right here in this life. And this is, of course, one of the important things about Buddhism, is that it's not something about a future life. Enlightenment and understanding these teachings can be done right here in this life. This is a promise of Buddhism. And it's a very important promise because it means that the results can be achieved now. You don't have to wait to look till after you're dead to see the results. They are available right here in this life. And they're available also in much smaller measure, in the sense that if you practice rightly, if you are kind, if you are compassionate, you will see it has an effect on yourself. Of course, it also has an effect on people around you, because if you're kind, it affects others. There's a beautiful kind of duality here. If you do something good, and this is one of the ways that I like to define a spiritual act, a real true spiritual act is something which is good for you, but it's also good for others. If it's good for both, then you know it's a spiritual act. One where it's only good for one of them is not a real spiritual act. So it's not really the case that the happiness that you do in this life only has to do with future lives. It also has very much to do with how you develop the mind in this particular life. In fact, the only way why you can have a good rebirth, according to Buddhism, is precisely because you develop your mind in this life. Because the mindset that you have when you die, that is essentially the mind that you're taking with you into your future life. And that's why you can have a good future life. So in a sense, there is a very close correlation there in Buddhism between the mind that you have now and the one that you will take with you into the future existence. There's not, this is a, you know, not a kind of random thing at all. So that is the first question. You can come back to me on that one if you like. The other one is about attachment. You're saying that attachments, they perform a biological function. You have to look after your children, etc., and you can't just abandon them. And that is true. But the thing is that usually we have too much attachments. It's not that we have too little. And the problem is that even if you were a long, long, long way on the path, you wouldn't give up your children just because of that. Because there's always enough attachment left. And even if there isn't any attachment, you still have a sense of responsibility towards those children. You still feel, well, I must look after them because they're my kids. People don't become irresponsible just because they practice this path. They still have a sense of responsibility there. The point, rather, is that the less attachment you have for your children, the less stupid things you do in bringing them up and helping them out. Because if you have a mind which is clear, which is free of desire, free of anger, free of attachment, your mind is much more clear. You can see more clearly what actually is the benefit of those children rather than you could otherwise. So it actually is a tremendous benefit to have less attachments. The less attachment you have towards anybody, the more powerful and the better that relationship is going to be to that person, whoever it is, whether it's a family member, whether it's a friend, whoever it is, it's going to be more powerful. Maybe I should give an example, because this is, I think, is an important point to understand why it is that the mind is more clear if we have no attachments. If you have attachments, you tend to also have desires and anger. Now, if we are angry, you know what it's like if you're angry sometimes. You think that you should say something, you think that you should do something, which otherwise you might not do. At the time when you're angry, it seems right. I have to say this to this person, even though it might not be a nice thing to say, because you think it would be, they deserve it, they should hear this, they have to hear this, etc., etc. And then afterwards, when your anger has passed and you're feeling okay again, you have regret saying that thing or doing that thing, because you realize afterwards that it was a mistake to say that thing at the time. I think this is quite a common experience among human beings. And the reason why you said the wrong thing when you were angry, well, because at that time it seemed right, but your mind was distorted by anger. Once the anger is over, the distortion is gone, you see things as it actually is, you wouldn't do it anymore. And this is exactly the same thing with attachment in life. The mind is distorted, and because of that, you cannot see always clearly what is in the best interest of the person who you're with at the time. Okay.
If I understand correctly, it means that there should be some amount of attachment, but it's just the appropriate amount, right? And the example you gave about anger and things like that, it seems more the management of the anger rather than lack of attachment, if you're talking in terms of a relationship. I see them as two different things. As attachment is that the bond, and you know, if something happens that's dislike, that you dislike, cause you angry, that is your value system. It's nothing, not so much of the attachment problem. Yeah, that's my understanding.
Okay. Yeah.
So when we have things like the quantity or the amount of attachment, I think that is a very difficult thing to gauge. How much is too much? How little is too little? Yeah?
I think ultimately, even if you have, as I said before, even if you have no attachment whatsoever, you're still going to have a sense of responsibility to those children. You're not going to give it up. There are, in the Buddha scriptures, there are suttas about people who were very, very, very developed spiritually, you know, much more developed than you would normally find these days. And yet, they still had children, and they still had families. So it takes a long, long time before you get to the point where you just give up everything and you're not really interested in your children anymore. I wouldn't be so concerned about that one. My point about being attachment and having the fact that your view is distorted is that it's true that anger and attachment are slightly different, but they go together, anger and attachment. Because if you have attachment, it's much more easy to get angry. But the other thing which goes with attachment is desire. If you are the reason why you are attached to somebody in the first place is because you think that they are a source of happiness for you one way or another. You're attached to your family because without them, you would feel a sense of emptiness. You would feel a life wouldn't be the same. So it gives you a sense of fulfillment, of contentment, a sense of purpose in life to have that family, children or whatever it is. But because there is desire there, because sometimes there can be anger involved with attachment, desire also has a distorting effect, not only anger. And a classical example, of course, is people who have extramarital affairs. At the time, it seems right. You think, I must do this. But afterwards, you come back and you tell your husband or wife or they find out or whatever, and you feel terrible about it. And you wish for your life that you had never done it. And this remorse arises. But at the time, it seems like the right thing to do. And this is the power that desire has to distort the mind. And of course, all kind of desire, even if it just relates to your family or your children, it might not distort the mind as much as that, but it will still distort the mind to a certain extent. And that is why you won't be able to see clearly what is to the benefit and advantage of that person.
Good evening, Ajahn. You talk about science and Buddhism, right? How do you reconcile the in your pursuit of this scientific truth, what is the scientific truth of rebirth? Yeah.
Okay. It's actually pretty much the topic for tomorrow's night's talk. Are you going to come tomorrow? Yeah. Not tomorrow. It's Friday. Friday. Tomorrow's Ajahn Brahm. on Friday. So if you're coming on Friday, yeah, might be better to leave it for then. Otherwise, I'm saying the same thing twice. But essentially, I'll give you a brief answer because you're here. You might not be here on Friday. But essentially, the interesting thing, if you start to read what science actually has to say about the mind, for example, you realize very quickly that science doesn't really have a very good understanding of the mind. The mind is still kind of terra incognita as far as science is concerned. They don't know what's going on. And you will often, if you read scientific journals and you read what scientists say about this, they say that this is one of the difficult questions in science, understanding the mind, understanding consciousness. So when scientists say that they don't believe in rebirth, it's not because they have fully understood the mind yet. They are saying it rather as a general matter of principle, I think, that because the idea of rebirth is a religious one, they take as a starting point that it's not true. I think that is a scientific starting point where they start off from. But as yet, they have very little understanding of what the mind is like. And the interesting thing is that you actually find some scientific evidence which points towards the idea of rebirth. And this scientific evidence is particularly, there's one man, one doctor who was working in the US. He was doing research for about 40 years into this. I'm not going to go into details, but his research was so powerful and so strong towards showing that rebirth was at least possible, that another professor, he said about his research that if you don't take this seriously, that would be irrational. It would be irrational not to believe that this is very good evidence for rebirth. That was a professor of philosophy at the university in the US who said that. It would be irrational not to believe that rebirth is the best explanation for this particular research that was done. So this is just my perspective on this. I mean, obviously, because I'm a monk, I'm interested in these kind of questions myself. And this is my research and my understanding that this is still a very unresolved issue in science. The one who did the research, his name is Ian Stevenson, and he did the research on memories of past lives, because memories can be verified, right? If you have a memory of a particular thing, you can verify whether it's true. You can go and see, is the house the color he said it was? Is the mother's name? Is this person such and such? So you can verify memory. That's the good thing about it. And the other person who said that his research was so good, his name is Robert Almeder. Robert Almeder, you can find him on YouTube, and he's interviewed on YouTube, and he will give his ideas there about why Ian Stevenson's work is so powerful. And he's a professor of philosophy. So it's that makes it quite interesting here.
Hi, how are you, Ajahn? Just want to ask a question. I mean, with in terms of our daily interactions with people, I have this internal struggle between being assertive versus learning to let go. Because, when you learn to let go means to let it pass. But, in day-to-day interactions, things are not as easy as it seems to be. And if you don't be assertive, then things would also not work well. So how would you manage it, and what would you suggest the mindset, or rather the paradigm, should be?
I think it's important to find that right balance and know when to be assertive and when to let go. Because there are certain times when it's important to be assertive. There are certain times when if you're not assertive, something will go very wrong and it might actually impact other people in a negative way. Then it's good to be assertive. But the point is, if you're going to be assertive, do it in a kind way. Do it with a kind heart. Don't get angry. Don't get upset about things. And this, I think, is the important thing, is how we are assertive in our lives. It's amazing how assertive you can be and still come from kindness, because you can still be very firm, in a sense. You will see some of these famous Ajahns who are supposed to be enlightened in Thailand. They can be extremely strong personalities, very, very powerful personalities, almost fierce, you would say. And you were taken aback, they would blow you backwards, and you would never argue with them, I can assure you. Whatever they said, that was it, And it's the same way, because, and many of these wouldn't have much anger in them, some of them might be completely enlightened even. It's the same thing with you. You can be assertive, but try to do it without being angry, without being upset, without having desires. Do it out of, because you understand that this is the best for everybody, this solution. And there are other times when you realize that, well, it doesn't really matter so much, who cares who is right in this particular case, and you can just let it go and not worry about it. So this is your decision. You have to know when it's important and when it isn't.
Yeah, I have another question, is that it's tough being positive, practicing positive psychology in like tough times, because at the end of the day, it really depends on an individual's resilience. And what would you advise that, what kind of mindset should we take? Because if, you're facing a tough time and you're looking in terms of positive psychology and everything, but, they come to be a dead end and you don't know, there's a negative spiral thing going, what would you do?
There's many things you can do. First thing, and this was one of the reasons for the talk tonight as well, is to remind yourself that you have something else in life. You have a spiritual path. In the long run, this is going to make you much more happy, give you much more contentment than anything the world can do. So just that reminder that you are already on the way to something better, something worthwhile in your life, that is often enough to take the worst of the edge away. That is important. Another thing which you can do, and which I should maybe have mentioned, which I didn't mention in my talk, is that when you have a crisis like this, it's an enormously good opportunity to develop compassion. Because so many people around you are suffering, having a hard time, maybe losing their jobs, reduction in salaries, maybe they have to sell their houses, all kind of terrible things happening around you. It's a chance for compassion, because everybody is suffering. Everybody pretty much is affected one way or another by this kind of crisis. And that compassion then becomes again a way of developing the spiritual path and focusing on others rather than focusing on yourself. The reason you feel down is because you're focusing too much on your own problems. By focusing on somebody else instead, understanding and having understanding for them, you're developing compassion, you're developing your own mind, and you are feeling better also about yourself. And of course, ultimately, you want to include yourself as well into that compassion. Understand your own suffering, have compassion for yourself, and realize this is life. There's no need to get upset or angry or depressed. This is the way it is. And just have compassion for these things, and turn slowly towards spiritual matters rather than material things.
Good evening, Ajahn. I'd like to ask about attachment. How do we let go of attachment of our self-perception? Meaning to say, for example, a lot of people, they have a different perception of themselves, like I'm such and such and such. But this kind of attachment is not really very obvious to each one of us because we cannot really see how we perceive ourselves. So sometimes when we do things wrong, or then only we start to realize that, oh, we are. This is our perception. How do we let go of this attachment?
I think this is a very deep-seated, deep-seated attachment. It's very profound. And in fact, if you look at the Buddha's teaching as a whole, and you realize this is actually one of the things that we're supposed to uncover as part of the Buddha's teachings. This idea, this identity with with our mind and with our body and who we think we are and what we are, our perception of ourselves. This is what makes Buddhism basically, the idea that we have to let go of this kind of thing. So I would, the important thing at the outset of the path is just to try to be honest with yourself, who you are as a person. Try to see where your weaknesses are, where your strengths are, build on the strengths and try to avoid the weaknesses in the future, and build up the spiritual path from that point. That is more important. Don't try too hard to analyze yourself and figure out who you really are and who you're not and what is part of you and what isn't part of you. Because ultimately what you will find is everything, all of this stuff, there's nothing in there which is really you anyway. You're just this bundle of conditioned phenomena according to Buddhism. That's pretty hard to grasp. And because it is so hard to grasp, I wouldn't get so much into that. Understand the philosophy by all means, understand how it works, but the actual full penetration of that kind of thing, the full understanding of that, only happens as a very deep level of insight, and it comes quite late on the path.
For us who lives in the world, those who need to work, they need to create some sort of self-identity whereby when the people need to interact with each other, for example, when you present yourself, it somehow enroots your perception of yourself.
Sure.
Because you need to have this kind of perception of yourself. But end of the day, from Buddhism point of view, you need to uproot this kind of self-perception which creates a lot of suffering.
Yeah.
So it becomes like a contradicting point whereby either it's either this or that.
Yeah.
So where do you balance that?
Okay, I see what you mean. And this is actually another thing I could have brought up tonight, is that one of the reasons why people suffer so much in these hard economic times is because their sense of identity gets challenged. If you lose your job, if your salary goes down, if maybe you lose your house, you lose your partner, and other people start thinking, well, before he was such and such, he was important, now he's just an ordinary guy or whatever. And people lose their social position and they lose a sense of identity of who they are. And that is very painful and it's very difficult. And that is one of the reasons why a crisis like this can be very hard on people. And that's why often they commit suicide. You have people who identify with being a wealthy person in a high social position, and suddenly nobody anymore. Of course, it can be very, very hard. The point here is really that what we have to do, instead of identifying with all these things, instead of building up a personality based on who we want to be in a particular job situation, whatever, we have to build up the sense of who we are on a spiritual basis instead. And it becomes very beautiful if you, the more you practice a good life, the more kindness you have in yourself, the more compassion you have, the more you practice the precepts, after a while, you start to identify with these things. You start to feel, this is who I am. This is the person I am. And because you identify with such beautiful qualities, you get enormous amount of self-esteem and self-worth. You feel really good about yourself because of this. And that is much more important, because then when you go to a job interview or you go to work, you're not so concerned anymore about presenting a particular face or anything like that. If they like you, it's fine. If they don't like you, who cares, basically? That's probably what you feel like, Gives you incredible strength inside, and that is the beautiful thing. So that is the kind of identity you want to create for yourself, a spiritual identity. And then as you climb up the spiritual ladder, as you become meditate more and more, that spiritual identity will increase and become more and more powerful as you go up. And then you let go, as they have in the old simile, you get let go of a lower rung on the ladder, and you grasp onto something higher. And you create an identity which becomes more and more beautiful. And as that identity becomes more and more beautiful, it also becomes weaker and weaker. You feel less and less that this has anything to do with me. And more you become just a very natural natural person. You just are who you are, basically. Yeah.
We have time for one more question.
Good evening. I understand that our soul is actually influenced by our mind's interests and attachments. And when we end our life here, our soul actually goes to the astral world and the spiritual world to go through training. But when that happens, is the mind still attached to the soul?
Okay. Well, that's interesting, because in the sutta, the Buddha said there are these 10 questions you can't answer. I think it's one of those questions. Because the basis for the question is wrong according to Buddhism. So the problem is with the question is that it assumes that there is a soul. But the point is in Buddhism that we don't assume there is a soul in Buddhism. In Buddhism there is only a mind. And it's actually the mind itself which goes from this life into a future life. And there's no soul there. So that's all there is. It takes away that whole problem of attachment between the soul and the mind and all these things. Do you want to come back on that one, or do you want to?
So if you say the mind goes there, I mean goes up, right? And it's actually reborn again. And the mind doesn't have this memory of the past.
It can have. It depends on the situation. I'm not sure why it is that there are some human beings who have memories of past lives. There are young children are famous sometimes for having memories of past lives. It could be, this is speculative, but it could be that the experience of living in a womb for 9 months and being born and all these things is so traumatic that maybe you lose memories of the past. This is speculation. I don't know. But there are certainly, according to Buddha, there are other beings who are live in different realms, and they do have memories of past lives. So it really depends on the circumstances. So, yeah.